You're listening to Scriptlock, where we talk about storytelling in video games. I'm Nick Folkman.
And I'm Max Folkman. Today's guests are Olivia Wood and Jessica Krause. Olivia is a writer, narrative designer, and editor, and currently works for Fail Better Games, where she's worked on Fallen London, Sunless Sea, Sunless Sea, Submariner, and Sunless Skies. She's also freelanced for games like Lethophobia, The Mystery of Calchemy Isle, Cheaper Than Therapy, and Where the Water Tastes Like Wine. Jessica is a former lead writer at Telltale Games, where she worked on Batman, The Walking Dead, Guardians of the Galaxy, and The Wolf Among Us Season 2. And since then, she's written for WB Games San Francisco and is currently working with Bad Robot Studios and Google Stadia. Thank you two for coming on.
Oh, my pleasure.
So we'll start with the question we always start with. Olivia, how did you get into the games industry?
Well, this is actually my second time around. When I was 18, I was dating a guy who worked for Sony PlayStation. And I took a gap year because I didn't quite know what I wanted to do at university. And I needed a job. And he's like, oh, why don't you work in QA? And I was like, all right, because I played a lot of games then. And so I actually ended up working for Eidos on Soul Reaver 2, Timesplitters 2, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, which nearly drove everyone in QA completely insane because Chris Tarrant's voice every day, all day, it's cause for murder.
Oh, you didn't have Regis?
I mean, I actually pretended I could speak fluent Italian so that I could listen to a version of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire that wasn't his voice, even though I had no idea what was going on. So that's how good QA was back then.
Was this a point-and-click trivia game? Because I'm pretty sure I played that as a kid.
yeah, it nearly killed me. But it was just like 4 or 5 months, and like no one told me this could be a career, that you could actually work in games. And so I then went and did serious kind of university stuff and then converted to law. And so I was doing all the, you will do a proper adult job, and then kind of went, I don't want to be a lawyer. This isn't fun. This is really depressing. Moved into editing because I wanted to work with stories and narrative and stuff like that. And I was doing a lot of sci-fi and fantasy. And from there, I shifted into video games because Fail Better in particular have a lot of writing and a lot of story. And I was just basically going, why on earth are all these writers not being edited? This is horrendous. And kind of came full circle about a decade later, which sometimes makes me a little bit rueful because I feel I could have done so much more in that time. But I've kind of enjoyed what I've done anyway.
Has your QA experience been helpful for your work in games now?
Be nice to QA. They're amazing. I mean, they genuinely are. I think a lot of people do think QA is just playing games, and it was kind of when I did it. And now I experience real QA at the current company. I'm like, holy shit, they're very important when done properly.
QA are like the heroes of every single game that ships ever.
Is QA a lot different now than it was back when you're doing Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
I mean, we have such a rigorous QA system, and like Les, who's our main person at work, she's brilliant. She will find all sorts of problems, also identify like all the ways to recreate them and then get them in the system, which sounds like what I should have been doing when I was working at Eidos, but really we were just like, hey, play the game, Olivia. In my case, oh, you completed it. The game's too easy. We'll put that as a bug. And I'm like, you're all assholes. It's very much in the past was kind of like just play it and see what happens, as opposed to a rigorous system that actually worked out how to cover the entire game. So I think it's definitely a lot more structured now.
Okay. And has your lawyer experience been helpful for your game's work?
Yeah, don't give me a shit contract. I'll read it. it's basically where it comes down to. It's like people go, oh, you should sign this. And I'm like, okay, after I've read it. And they're like, did you know this bit's in it? They're like, oh, no, everyone signs this thing. I'm like, no, I don't. So it's useful in that sense. I think people take me more seriously than they should, so don't tell people that. But it stops people from taking the piss, even though it doesn't in any way empower me to really do anything about it. It's enough.
Since all of us are freelancers, what kind of bad contracts have you seen? Like, what stuff do you like commonly catch?
Well, like, it was like a clause in one of the previous, way back, a draft of, which basically said anything you created outside the company was owned by the company. And I'm like, you know, this actually means if I sent my boyfriend nudes, the company would own those. Like, this is such a wide rights grab that it wouldn't hold up in court. So it's one of these things where it wasn't even protecting the company, because as soon as it does something that's just too big, the court will go, well, obviously that's ridiculous, so strike that clause down. But it's things like that where they're trying to protect their own, themselves by saying, we don't want our employees to work on stuff outside. And instead, they don't understand what it means to say everything you create belongs to us. Because, I mean, literally everything you create. Okay, that letter to my mum, the email, you now own it. It's it's a silly clause because it doesn't protect them either.
What about you, Jessica?
My brain's still on the nudes to boyfriends can be considered company property. Holy shit, I never even considered that. Oh my god. Anyway, yeah, my background is pretty much exclusively in writing. I went to college for playwriting and screenwriting, and I also didn't realize that working on games was a job until like junior year of college, when I had a professor and she was like, oh yeah, you can totally like write for games and you should play these games because they have good stories in them. And I was like, games have stories? What? Even though I had been playing like Assassin's Creed for years, as like, it never, I don't know why, it just never registered in my brain. And so about like a year after I was out of college, I had moved back home because I went to college in New York, but then moved back home with my parents in Pennsylvania. And I was working a really, really terrible job as a school photographer, and absolutely miserable. And on my downtime, I would go on the company computers and just like be like, what do I need to do to get a job as a writer? And coming from a background of playwriting and screenwriting, I was under the impression it was a lot harder. Which sounds ridiculous, but I had been, you know, put under the assumption that the only way you get anything produced is if you get representation, and the only way to get representation is to win a bunch of, like, writing contests and shit like that. And then I started looking at game companies, and they just had listings posted on their websites, and I was like, this is the promised land. And applied for an assistant job, got rejected, had a bit of a temper tantrum, and, like, went for a walk, and then I was like, okay, it's fine, I don't have experience. And then about 6 months later, there was a listing for a writing internship for the summer at Telltale. And I was like, fuck it, might as well. And I ended up getting it. Me and another girl, both out of college, hilariously, even though the listing was like, we want college students. And we were just kind of like, nope. So yeah, I feel like I got into the industry way too easy. I feel like I kind of like drunk food my way into a company, because as soon as the internship ended, I was hired full time, and then I was there until the bitter end, which was in September.
So our game's the promised land.
Well, as someone who keeps a tally of all the rejections I've gotten, I'm just kind of like, maybe not. I don't know. But it's also like the most, it is strangely enough, like the most consistent writing work to get. Because if you get in with a company and you're there for, you know, I mean, I was with Telltale for 2.5 years. That is so much better than what my prospects would be if I had gone into television or film or, God, theater. Theater is like impossible to make happen.
Yeah, I was going to say, because I worked in publishing as an editor, and the hourly rates in that, I mean, publishing is awful. It's when insane. You come into video games and it's like, well, salaries here are amazing. People look at you and you're like, relative to publishing? but yeah, it might not make you rich, but at least you can make a living writing for video games, which I think is very rare. And if, say, if you want to do linear fiction books and stuff, if you strike it lucky, then good. But the number of people who do that is 1% of writers. I think video games is easier to just exist as a writer and live off it.
Do you feel like there are more jobs becoming available for writing in games, or is it like going down or staying the same as it's been for the last couple of years?
I think that, and granted, I didn't do a whole lot of like massive looking before I got my Telltale job, and I really didn't start looking until after the company closed down. But I think there has been an increase of writing jobs recently, especially, you know, I think with the success of even just the past year, we have all these incredible games that are so... story is so integral to them. You have Insomniac's Spider-Man, you have God of War, you have all these games that are now actually focused on story, and so, you know, you need people to write that, and sometimes narrative designers can do it too, and sometimes the game is too big and you need a writer, and I think it slowly we're getting more opportunities, and it's nice.
Yeah. I feel like with stuff like Bandersnatch, there's more game writing adjacent jobs becoming available too, with more companies trying to do interactive live action, interactive animation stuff.
Yeah, it's a really interesting kind of space we're in right now, because I'm consulting with a company, Echo, which basically does live action, choice-based short stories, I guess. But yeah, it's really interesting where we're trying to like bleed the lines between what is a game and what is television.
Yeah, totally.
I slightly chuckled at that because quite a few people I know are consulting with Echo, which is lovely.
We have so many. When I had my first call with them, he's like, we've got a whole list of people from Telltale. And I was like, all right.
But
they're good
nice.
People. They're great people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's also because interactive fiction is kind of coming up. Before, it was the kind of, it's not AAA. It's not massively autistic. It's not shooting. And it seems in the last few years that choices in dialogue and choices in storyline have really made a difference. And it's just lovely to see what used to be people just making Twine games actually getting serious jobs and respected for their skills, because that people are recognizing that just because it's presented as text on the screen, it's still valid and valuable.
Yeah, totally. So you've both worked with branching narratives and choices. What do you think makes a good, meaningful choice?
Who goes first here? Okay, I did actually think about this a little, because you warned me you might ask us. I don't think meaningful choices are necessarily the most dramatic option. I think they're the ones that make people go, holy shit, I have to think about this. Or if they just take a decision and then they go, oh my God, that's the outcome. And in that case, it shouldn't be a horrible surprise. It should be an inevitable surprise. So it could be a choice as simple as, why did you do this thing you've just done? Or it could be an active choice in the situation with how are you going to approach the scene. But it's very much contextual. So if it's an intimate game about friendships, for example, something very indie perhaps, it could simply be, why did you ask that person to leave your flat? And that point there could give you a place for the player to insert their own story on the character. But at the same time, meaningful choice in a different game could be absolutely completely different, and nothing so personal or small. It's very contextual, but I think it's ones that make the player go, oh yes, I have to think about this, or that's why this happened. It's they pause.
Do you tend to think of like what's the most dramatic way to do it?
No. I mean, I think that's a trap. Like, obviously it can be fun to have a big dramatic thing, but I think if the most interesting choice is the most dramatic choice, it's always going to be high stakes, and the player doesn't get a chance to relax. And I think if you keep someone on like an upward straight line, you never actually kind of get the pleasure or the peaks and the troughs. So I think I actually prefer pensive choices, where it's not, you've got 3 seconds to make a choice, someone's going to shoot you. It's, what is the best thing to do in this situation? Bearing in mind all these factors that you maybe can't even choose the best one. You can choose the least bad or the one that's most personally appropriate. I love giving players choices where someone is not going to be happy no matter what you do, but trying to still make it feel satisfying rather than them resenting me for it. It's just my personal quirk. It's like, no, you don't get to be happy. I'm not going to let you be happy. Life isn't like that, but I will make it interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I find that the choices that resonate most with me are ones that concern characters. And like, you know, it is interesting when it's like a life or death choice or like a moral choice. Those can be very interesting if you build up to them correctly. But I think if you tie them to characters, then you have an emotional investment as a player. One of the ones that I kind of always come back to is in season one of Wolf Among Us, which I played before I was at Telltale. I was a huge fan of that game before I joined the company. So this is me speaking as a fan. But there's a choice in like episode 4 where you find the tree that's being used to make illegal glamours. And you can either burn down the tree, because that's what Snow White wants you to do, who I have been having like an on and off relationship with, sort of. A will they, won't they, shall we say. Or I can like hire the witch and not burn the tree. And so it's tied to this, you know, decision of like, in that moment, I don't think Snow White is morally correct. But if I'm trying to play towards her and trying to play, you know, to get in her favor, then I need to destroy the tree. And so it's like, it's a moral choice ultimately, but it is one that's tied to character. It's about what Snow White's going to think, and is she going to like your choice or not? And so for me, those are the choices that I enjoy. Even ones where it's like, oh, you know, one character won't like if I go left, but one character won't like if I go right. But if I've been investing all of my time with the character that doesn't want me to go left, then I won't go left, you know? So more of like prioritizing how people feel. And I think that's also the best feedback loop also is character feedback rather than environmental. Because if, and I think it's just like me as like a person who is like filled with guilt, but like if a character tells me that they're disappointed in my choice, then I'm like, oh no, I did wrong. Much more than like if a bridge collapses under me because I decided to go right instead of left.
What's my favorite bridge?
I had emotional attachment to that bridge.
I was going to say, like, actually trying to give an example for my slight waffle on it not having to be an action. An example that sometimes comes up when we discuss it at work is the skin of regret in Torment, in that you get to choose what action your character regrets. And I think that can be really interesting because it's choosing something you wish you hadn't done.
Yeah.
So it's making you focus on all this stuff, but it's also making you think about your previous choices and therefore giving an extra layer of meaning to them now. So it strengthens all the choices you've done in the past. So it's kind of got a double layer in itself. And obviously, again, something you can't do too often, but as a one-off moment, it's incredibly powerful because you have to sit down and think all the stuff your character's done and go, well, what do I regret the most? And asking that of the player just makes them think about their character rather than just play their character. That's something I'd like.
It's a great way for role-playing space as well to kind of like make that character unique to the player. That's really cool, yeah.
This makes you want to ask, like, Jessica, you just gave an example. You can give more if you want, but what are your favorite choices in games that you played?
One that I kind of like, I feel very clear in like how I chose it and like my choice. I'm very satisfied in my choice, but at the end of season one of Life is Strange, whether to basically sacrifice the entire town for my maybe girlfriend Chloe or kill Chloe because that's what the game is telling me to do. And I didn't. I sacrificed the town and ran off with Chloe, and that was the correct decision. But that was one of those where I was just like, oh shit. Like I knew what was, again, the morally correct answer, but I also had spent 5 episodes getting to know this girl and getting to understand her struggles and all the good parts of her and all the bad parts of her. And to me, I had the closest relationship with Chloe than with anybody else in the town. So for me, it was kind of an easy choice. But it is kind of interesting the way that they built up that choice to kind of turn into a trolley problem a little bit, sacrificing one person for the good of everybody else. But for about like 5 minutes, I kind of like stayed on that screen and I was like, which will give me the better ending? And then I was like, do I even care about which one gives me the better ending? I'm still going to choose Chloe over the town. Chloe is bae.
So like that was an easy choice for you?
It was, at the end of the day, like once I made the choice, it was an easy choice. But in the moment, like when I got that, when at the lead up and, you know, the storm swirling and they're asking you, what are you going to do? You know, you can sacrifice, and Chloe's like begging you to sacrifice her because she wants the town to survive. And yeah. So leading up to that choice, I was just kind of like, oh God, wait, no, fuck this. I can do what I want. And then I made the correct choice.
Because I want to know like both your favorite choices in games, but also are your favorite choices ones that you struggled with a long time, or were they like super easy and you still like they still really impacted you?
Ooh, I'm still trying to think of my favorite choice. Because there's actually a choice I love in Son of Skies, which sounds like, hey, I'm hyping my own game, but it's written by one of our freelancers, and I actually saw it when editing and started crying. But I don't actually want to talk about it because not many people have got to the end game. I'm like, I need to wait till people got there and then I can talk to them about it. So I'm now thinking of other ones. I've got one, I think, an interesting choice. I don't know if it's a good one. In Assassin's Creed Odyssey, it's one with Cassandra, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah.
I play characters that will just fuck everyone because that's how my characters do. And there's one island where you get a choice of two people, and if you sleep with one of them, then the other one's kind of okay with it. But when you do it the other way around, the person you don't sleep with basically demands to fight you to the death.
Oh yeah, and I know this one.
And I reset the game and went back and played like another 6 hours so that I didn't have to kill this person. I kind of liked. I just wanted to sleep with them both. I thought I'd be able to sleep with them both, not just one of them.
It's Grace,
I
man.
I was aiming for a threesome. But I still think about it because it was very powerful enough that I went, well, I'm not resting with this decision. I'm reloading. I'm going back however many hours into my last save, which was quite a long time, and replaying it so that neither of these people has to die. But at the same time, I don't know if that was good design because I was so cross with the outcome, I went back and redid the game. I kind of wasted 8 hours of my time. And I still haven't come down to that was so powerful writing that I couldn't let it stand, or that just didn't signal the consequence of my choice enough that I was frustrated with my choice. So I haven't decided if it's a good choice yet, but it was an interesting choice, and I'm glad I saw it in a game. I don't know if I approve of it.
So you think all choices should signal their outcomes in some way?
No, but I don't think all choices should not leave you with an unpleasant taste in your mouth. Like the kind of meme dialogue choice where you get a choice of, say, hello or good to meet you, and you click the hello one, it's like, ah, you asshole. And you're like, what? Yeah. What? This is not what my character chose. Like, yeah. That is, I don't think that's good, because you're trying to roleplay something and the game's going, that's not what you're roleplaying. And you're like, really? I thought I was from the information you gave me. So I think it needs to signal to that extent. But I think people should, with the benefit of hindsight, go, okay, that's fair. Like, they shouldn't get the expected consequence, but they shouldn't go, you pulled a bait and switch.
Yeah.
And I don't think in this case it was a bait and switch, which is why I think maybe it's a good choice, but the fact I went and replayed it means I'm not certain. Yeah, it's also like the whole thing when you put in the illusion of choice and then slam the door and go, no, you can't do that choice for this reason. That I also don't like. I mean, I know why it's done, because you can't write 40,000 endings, which it would be if you branched off from every choice, but you have to be a bit more subtle about it.
I think the one where the illusion of choice actually works really well, and I'm saying this mostly because it's my favorite game, is BioShock Infinite. Has several moments where you get to quote-unquote choose, and then they basically are just like, no, it doesn't. You thought that choices mattered in this. They don't. But it's done so elegantly, and it's done really well within the story, that I just, like, I don't care that the choices didn't matter, because they're also not, there's so few in the entire game as a whole. There's only, like, I think there might be two or three. It's not a lot. But I like how it sets you up to think that you have free will, and then it basically, the entire thesis of the game is that you don't have free will. And so that's where I think illusion of choice actually works. But if it's actually a game that is trying to give you...
if that's part of the theme, then it works.
But right, exactly. It's part of the theme, it's part of the story. But if it's like, if you're actually in a branching game and you're given choices that don't actually lead to anything, that doesn't actually... Or ones that just kind of backpedal, those aren't really super satisfying, which is something we try to combat a lot at Telltale.
How do you combat that?
It depends on the choice, because we would have like smaller choices, which is the ones that are most frequent, and then we would have like tentpole choices. We usually had anywhere from like 3 to 5 tentpole choices per episode. And the tentpoles were ones that we were kind of like, okay, this is where the branch happens. Batman Season 2 does it, where you basically are set on a path where the entire fifth episode is branched. We did it, we kind of did like the prototype version of that in Guardians, where we had 2 choices in Episode 3 and 4 that completely branched Episode 5. But my brain just blanked. I was like, what the fuck was I talking about?
well, I can say a way of managing choices so that you actually have outcomes from them without creating too many different storylines.
Yes.
Yeah. Have characters respond to you differently, but the plots stay the same.
Exactly. That's kind of what we ended up turning towards. It's like the big temple choices weren't always ones that would be like huge branches. They would end up being like huge character branches. Like you would choose whether to go with this character or this character, and that changed their your loyalty essentially, and that's where your branch kind of comes from.
Olivia, were you gonna say something else too?
Yeah, sorry, I interrupted.
I don't know, it was merely just how you can do it. I think you've done it in some Telltale games, but for example, because we don't have VO, we can write text fairly cheaply.
Yeah.
And we can have a variable, so we'll have a basic level of the relationship between you and a character is X, and that will be the dialogue. And then you do a choice, and it might not affect the plot, but then you'll have them be a little bit more shitty to you or be a bit nicer to you, and we're literally just swapping out a token for a sentence of dialogue. And that alone can be enough to go, no, we've acknowledged your choice, it matters. We don't do this all the time, but it's just where we want a choice to be recognised, but actually don't have the space to break the story up. So it's simple, and it really can be effective.
Both of you worked in really very branching narratives. We have branching stories. How much are you thinking about, if you are thinking about it, like trying to get players to go back and experience the other branches that they haven't seen?
Fail Better Games are very, very specific kind of games. And when we write them, we also narrative design them, and we talk them through with Chris, particularly for Sun the Sky. So the person who is above will already have insight into the game, into the story from the particular start. And I think we want people to feel that one playthrough can be satisfying and enough. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the choices drive conversations in the forums, and people ask what the other outcomes are or try to see profiles or look for videos. And the choices they don't see need to be tempting enough that people talk about them. So it doesn't have to be so much that they want to go and replay them, though that's nice, and often they do. It's that they want to know what's missed, so they stay involved. And I don't want to say like I am maintaining engagement, but I think it creates an extra layer to the gameplay when the players themselves interact and talk about what their character and what they did as one of the characters. So it's very much, oh, I would never do this because I'm role-playing this type of character. And they almost have discussions in character across the forums. And it's interesting to watch, but also it's just a lovely consequence of having choices that actually mean something rather than, it didn't matter what you do.
Yeah, it's never really, for me, it's not really a priority whether they come back and play the game again, because much like you said, Olivia, you know, it feels like one playthrough should be your true playthrough. If you want to go back and explore and see what the other endings are or what the other, you know, what the other side of the coin is, that's great. I think our job from a development standpoint is just to make sure every branch is interesting enough where no matter what you choose, you're still getting a satisfying ending, or you feel confident enough in your choice that maybe, I don't know. 'Cause like sometimes, especially for, I think certain people in development, higher ups, do you want replayability? But I think that should be kind of up to the player.
Yeah. Needs to take into account the length of games nowadays.
Yeah.
Like, if your game is a 3-hour game, then sure, you want people to replay it and experience other aspects of it. But even if you want the player to be able to feel that they regret a choice, just to feel they've invested that much in a game, if their game takes 80 hours to complete, do you really want to be making them feel that they have to do it twice to actually get the full satisfaction of the game? Like, to me, that's slightly... it's not evil, but it's not right. Like, people should be satisfied with the time.
It's a little sadistic.
I don't know. I barely get enough time to play games that friends have worked on, ones I want to play. And the idea that I have to do them twice, I'm like, I can't. Like, I put 100 hours in Skyrim. Like, I want to finish that game. I've not even finished it, but like, I can't. And the idea that I'd have to play it twice, I'm just like, oh, no, that's just unfair.
Yeah.
I think it should be satisfying enough, and with a long game, there should be moments you're allowed to regret, but there should be enough strength behind even the decisions you regret that you stick with them.
Yeah.
And like, that's this is my mistake.
Yeah. And that's the great thing about, you know, you talked about it earlier, you know, forums and fan Twitter and Let's Plays and things like that, because, you know, you do get that conversation of people being like, well, in my playthrough, this happened instead of this because I chose this. And like, that's, to me, that's enough to just see that several people have tried different paths. But yeah, I don't think it's necessarily a requirement.
Does that ever surprise you? Like getting the reactions from Twitter or other fans when you're playing through and seeing what their choices were?
I don't think so. I mean, we designed to try and make the choices all tempting for mm-hmm. one reason or another, or sometimes to put it in obviously, this is obviously a terrible thing to do choice, because some players love it. Like, some players want to take the most masochistic choice they can possibly find. And yeah. You know, there's always going to be people like that. So it's not that. I mean, I'm always touched when people care enough to actually say something, particularly if they tag us in, because we do get notified of all the tags, and like, we even have a channel in Slack called Love, so that when people have sent us a message about how something matters to them, we can read it. And that's incredible. But it's not about surprise at which choice they took.
Yeah. Sometimes, especially in like, mostly in like our comedy games, we would put in like certain Easter eggs, and that would get a bit of a, like, not surprise, but a little bit of excitement if someone found a certain Easter egg or something. There's a funny little gag from episode 2 of Guardians of the Galaxy where there's just a trail of candy, and if you follow the trail of candy all the way through the ship, because it's supposed to be like this mystery of like, who's leaving the candy around? And then you get to the end and it's in Peter's room and you're playing as Peter and he just goes, it was me. Which is just a cute little like thing where it's like 5% of players will see. But when people see that and they're like, oh, I found the candy trail, it's like, oh, cool. That's really sweet. So for me, it's like the little tiny like moments like that. I had a fan once post on Tumblr, I think, about two side characters in episode 5 of Guardians, which are both characters only appear on one branch. And they were like, I ship these two characters. And I was like, oh, that was intentional. You are supposed to ship those. I'm glad you're the only person that pointed that out. But that kind of was like a nice little moment of like, oh, yeah, you saw what I saw. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Oh, that's cool. I have no segue for this. What makes a good NPC?
If I can romance them.
Oh, yeah. That wasn't going to be my answer at all. I had a serious answer.
Next question. That is serious.
My serious answer? For me, it's one with a personality strong enough the player can't impose a choice on them no matter what. Like, a character who you believe would say no if you said something unreasonable. And also one that won't mindlessly admire the player character just to make the player feel good.
Yeah.
This is probably something that used to happen more early on in games writing, but it would, like, you'd move a box and then an NPC would go, oh my God, you're the best person ever moving boxes. And you'd be like, you're being creepy now? Like, don't do this. I like them to feel like they exist for a purpose other than to push the player's story and to cheer the player. Like, they shouldn't be just this person continually running alongside you offering thumbs up.
Yeah. I really enjoy NPCs that challenge the playable character, but not in like an asshole way, but more in like they're not impressed with you way, almost. Like, one of my favorite NPCs is Yennefer in The Witcher 3, because she does not put up with Geralt's shit, and I love that about her. And actually, like, none of the sorceresses do. They're just kind of like, you ain't shit, dude. And it's so refreshing to have, especially in like an RPG where there are all these, you know, attractive women that I can romance and they just look at me like I'm a buffoon. It's kind of really refreshing because it's like, you know, games in the past, it's like if you're playing a male character and then all the female characters are like throwing themselves at you and you're like, you're amazing. But it's not like that in The Witcher.
Everyone hates Geralt in The Witcher.
Everyone hates Geralt, and I love it.
As someone who has played as many sex scenes as I can in The Witcher, I just wanted to check out the butts of the women he has sex with, because they have identical mole placement on, I think it's the right butt cheek.
They have,
like, it's the same butt.
Listen, I
love it.
There are issues with The Witcher, mostly coming from the fact that they only have like one male model. Well, no, they only have one female model, and they use it for every single female character in their game. There's one where you have to go find a woman and you ask someone who it is, and they're like, oh, it's that woman. She's the portly one. And I look over, and she's got the exact same model as every other woman in the game. And I was like, wow, this is awful. But, like, God.
Well, I was
still
in it for the butt mole. I was maybe all women have butt moles. Great.
I still love that game, but that game's fucking amazing. But there are some
Witcher 3 and the bit with, oh God, the Bloody Baron.
Oh yeah. God. God.
Right?
What a great, like, that is a character. That is a fucking great NPC.
Like, he's clearly awful, but he's also kind of sympathetic, but he's a monster, but you can kind of understand. And it's like, you almost hate yourself for feeling sympathy for him, but you can see it's very clever.
Yeah, he's definitely like, he's not my favorite character in the game, but he's the most compelling. And I mean, I love asshole characters that have like layers and depth, because it's been a thing since I was a kid. I always like gravitated towards like the redeemable asshole. But there's something so great.
That's where all the terrible relationships are. Films have got it wrong. Go for the nice people.
Yes, absolutely. Go for the good people. In fiction, you can go for the redeemable assholes. That's fine. But in the real world, go for the nice ones.
Yeah, they can redeem themselves, and then they can be talked to.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, my thing is, I love sarcastic, particularly women, like GLaDOS. I will never get, I love her. I adore her in every possible way.
And my iPhone is named GLaDOS and has been since I bought an iPhone. I love her so much.
It's so funny, but it's the fact, I like people who are powerless insulting you, because it takes the sting out of the insults and just makes them funny and makes the characters pathetic. And that's why I like it so much, because, like, no, I don't actually like people just coming up to me insulting me. If people did that, that would make me very sad. But when it's someone who is clearly doing it because they're so pathetic, they can't harm me, I'm just like, oh, this is brilliant. This actually makes me more powerful. That's all you've got?
Yeah.
I love it.
She's such a good
So
character.
Do you like Wheatley?
Wheatley can be set on fire. The moment he was taken away from me, like, now that... Yeah, I didn't like Wheatley, no. He needed punching. Which I think was the point, so well
done.
Oh,
yeah, yeah. No, they definitely followed through on that arc, and it's...
Please give me a punchable character.
Great.
There he is.
I also like smarmy characters. Those are fun. Like,
only if you can, like, pull the rug out from beneath them. Like, if they're just smarm, then I get a bit grossed out. But if they're smarm, and then you kind of pull it on, yeah.
No, absolutely. Like, not to a gross point. But I also like really intelligent... Like the Lutesses, I think, are great NPCs, mostly because, like, they don't actively do a whole lot in the game proper, but they're so integral to the backstory of that game. And they're always smarmy, and they're just like so sarcastic, and they're just like, we're smarter than you. And I'm like, yeah, you are. It's fine. I still love you.
There's some good smarmy people in Assassin's Creed Odyssey.
Yeah.
I was thinking about when you're talking about Olivia, the romance quest you were talking about, but the quest you're talking about is probably my favorite romance I've encountered so far. But the second favorite is the woman who just is ravenous for sex, and her husband is just like, please, I'm just immortal.
I love that.
I like the fact she's old as well. Like, one of my things is I because I'm the ripe old age of definitely younger than 40, I consider myself ancient. And I love old women who actually have personalities, and, like, because they're old, they don't give an even more fucks. This is it. They're done. They're out of fucks. They're in their, like, 90s or whatever. I love crones in games. Like, not witch crones, but crones who are just, like, life is funny. And I love those characters. So having a kind of this one woman who's, like, clearly, I don't know, she's 50s from the art. She's not someone in her 20s. It's not this kind of nympho, typical, beautiful character. It's just, do you want to sleep with this old woman? And then she's great. I love her.
The way that scene is also directed is brilliant, where it just cuts throughout, like, throughout the day, and it's like, it's day, and then it's dusk, and then it's evening, and then it's the next morning. It's so good. It's so well done.
Talking about how having NPCs that are overly praiseworthy to you will take you out of just that character, is there anything that will take you out of a game's story, like, the moment it comes up?
When the player character has to do something I consider incredibly cruel. I can't do it. But on the flip side of this, I watched my partner play one of the Resident Evils, and there's a lot of damage to hands, and it's one of my things. I just can't watch, and I could probably, if it was a cutscene, so you don't have to watch it and keep playing, I could do that. But you have to actually fight while your fingers are being chopped off and stuff, and I'm like, I physically can't look at the screen, so that makes me nope out. But and from a story angle, it's if the character has to do something just really cruel, like torture or sexual assault or rape or something like that, I'm like, nope, I'm out of this. And it's, I appreciate to some people this might be odd, because I quite like doing sniper headshots, I quite like stealth killing people, I'm all in the murder, happy for murder. But I think for me, killing people is not about I am killing a human being, it's I am removing a part of the puzzle to make the puzzle solvable. And I can't see that any way torturing or assaulting another person is part of puzzle solving. It feels like I am making your character humiliate or destroy something about another human being, and I just can't get into that. Yeah. That's not for me. Like, it might be for a, if you're trying to do a game about the life of some terrible person, but I just wouldn't play it. I think I have to be able to roleplay a character to a certain extent, and I refuse to be in that headspace.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, now that you say it, I'm like, oh yeah, that's definitely one of my like squicks and things. Because it's one, like you said, it's one thing to clear a bunch of enemies with a gun because you need to get to the door at the end of the room. It's another thing entirely to build up to like a scene where you're torturing someone and actually following through on that. And if you, and I can forgive it if there is the option to back out, not in, in torture, like, so there's a interrogation torture in The Wolf Among Us in where you can play it more pacifist and just question them, or you can go brutal because that's what your character is. I like the fact that there's a choice there on which route you want to take, and that I can get behind. But if it's just torture for the sake of torture, that'll take me out of it. I don't play any games that have sexual assault in them. I won't do it. Just from a principal standpoint.
Because you're unlikely to meet the victim of a murder, right?
Right.
Like, you're pretty likely to be a victim of some of the other things. It's like...
Yeah, yeah. I think it's just, yeah. It's some... I think it's also like the suspension of disbelief. It's like, I can suspend my disbelief to mow down a bunch of bad guys in a room because that's the main gameplay mechanic. But it's very difficult for me to suspend my disbelief when... doing some of the more like brutal things. I think too, for story wise, for dialogue wise, sometimes if a line is, and I'm guilty of this too, so it's when I find it in my own work, I'm like, ah, shit. But like really on the nose language that is very clearly trying to tell you what you're supposed to do, or just like,
an example,
like if you start a puzzle or something and the dialogue shifts, especially if it's like voiced, and the dialogue shifts from being something really natural and very, very conversational to suddenly like, you have to do this and this and this. Or like when there are certain lines where it's like, and this is the theme of the game. Did you know this is the theme of the game? And I was just
it's
like,
when they say the title.
Yeah. It's what they say. Sometimes they'll say the title and I'm just like, oh God, no. Like, I get it.
This is your Assassin's Creed.
Like, it's fine when it's like The Witcher, because like that's his role. Of course he's going to be called The Witcher a bunch. It's another thing entirely when it's like...
It's another thing when they say The Witcher 3 Wild Hunt.
And then you're just like, roll credits. All right. Is that the thing? What a cool
game. Okay, new question. What was one storytelling quagmire you found yourself in recently, and how did you get out of it?
Okay. It helps if I do a bit of structure. Like, in Sun of the Skies, we have, like, basic storylines at ports and stuff, and then we have the officer quests, which are, like, the NPCs that come with you. You can, once you've done their storyline, you can upgrade them or get experience. But they're basically, like, the main characters you'll see while you're playing. And I was given a trans officer to write. And I was really nervous about this because I'm not trans. I haven't had the trans experience and I didn't want to do it badly. Like, I've seen so many examples where games have done it badly, where they dead name someone or they just go, by the way, in case you didn't realize I'm trans.
Yeah.
And it's the whole thing of like putting a character in subtly enough that it doesn't feel like the story is about them being trans. It's their story as a person. But also that people can realize it, because people might not know. If someone doesn't say that, if there's, it's hard to convey. And because I was nervous about doing it well, I wanted to make sure they're a nice character. I didn't want people to dislike them. And what happened was I just had this really boring character. And Chris, who is my boss and very, very good at diplomatic feedback, just basically went like, you know, lovely people who are nice, but they're also fun and interesting. Why are they fun and interesting? Use that. And I was like, holy shit, why did I not think of this? But I was like so focused on, I must not fuck up this story. This is too important to our players, that I hadn't even thought of how I normally approach writing. I just got locked into this weird mindset. And so I started thinking about like who I should base this on and like what kind of characteristics I liked about these people, and just like stole them from real people. And then on top of that, we had a sensitivity consultation, which just meant I could actually take creative risks without worrying about whether they'd hurt anyone, because these people would go, this is okay. And actually, in the consultation, they said to me, you can actually make it clearer. You don't worry about it. You're being fine. And it just made it so much easier. I did a complete rewrite, and I think it's one of my favorite bits of writing now. But it started from me being so panicked about hurting people that I couldn't even write a normal character. It was a weird headspace to start in.
That's awesome, though.
Yeah. Mine's not nearly as interesting. mostly at my work at Telltale, a lot of times, you know, because we would have these quick time events and action sequences. And those were the ones that I would get hung up on the most, because like, I didn't know how to write it appropriately in order for it to be animated correctly, in order for the mechanics to be put in correctly. And at one point, you know, I can't remember if it was my designer or my director, but they're just like, just skip it. I can do that for you. I have an eye for mechanics. I have an eye for direction. I know what a Telltale action sequence looks like. Just, you know, skip it. Let me do it. And then you can come back around and add, you know, character and writing things to it. That's a sentence. And I don't know. It's just like, it's something that's really small and very inconsequential. Olivia's answer is much better than mine. But but yeah, learning
the same
to
thing as someone else.
Yeah, learning to
going, don't worry.
Yeah, and also just like learning to trust your other collaborators to kind of like have your back and to help you was really important. And And I'm still bad at writing action scenes, but I know that you should write them. Don't just write, add fight here. Do that for the first draft, and then come back around and then write it. Don't do a George Lucas, where I'm pretty sure in all the prequels he just wrote, fight goes here.
Hey, George Lucas, he's doing all right.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, so maybe listen, you maybe you should do that.
What do you do to combat rewrite fatigue? We don't know if you're making things better or worse.
Oh, God. like yesterday? Oh. I find, particularly when I'm tired, I'm not a particularly moody person, which may surprise some people, but when I'm tired, I cannot assess the quality of my own work. Mm-hmm. I just assume it's shit. Like, I don't even have any kind of, like, it's not, it could possibly be good, it could possibly be bad, I don't know. I'm just like, it's shit, I'm tired, it's shit. Since we've now launched fairly recently, we're quite lucky not to have that too much at the moment. But the only thing that's ever helped is time and distance since mm-hmm. the first rewrite. Yeah. Like getting some sleep, doing it another day. Because if I try and rewrite something when I've decided everything about it is shit, then I'm not rewriting it. I'm writing something new. When I'm writing something new miserably, it's, you just need the privilege of time.
Yeah. And I think having time is the best medicine. It's a little bit difficult when you have deadlines. Thankfully, at, you know, Telltale, we always had enough people around where I could go to another writer or I could go to my designer and say, hey, can you please read this and do a sanity check? Because I don't feel like this is going anywhere, but maybe it is hitting all the right notes. And I just need a second opinion, which was a huge benefit for Telltale. It's a lot harder doing it freelance. And when you're like the only writer, when you're the only holder of the story, it's very, very difficult for me to look at something and be like, am I in the right am I in the right ballpark? I don't know. I can't tell. So
how do you do it, Jessica?
I don't know. I'm still learning. I think I definitely agree with Olivia, just like stepping back and taking time and maybe focusing on something else and then coming back to it with a clear head is helpful. And sometimes you come back with a clear head and you look at what you had written like weeks ago and you're just like, oh, no, this is shit. I need to do another rewrite. So
if you have someone you can go to, sometimes just the act of saying out what your problem is, you'll just discover what
Absolutely.
You need to do without them even looking at what you've written.
Yeah, and
yeah, it's the rubber duck thing. Like we have a house writing Slack channel where I'm like, I have this problem, and start writing it down. And before anyone even starts typing, I'm like, I have solved the problem. Ignore me.
Ignore me.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think explaining a problem often takes you halfway there, because once you've worked out how to explain the problem, you've probably worked out what the problem is rather than just that there is a problem. And then I think once you know what the problem is, it's a lot easier to fix. Often with writing, my initial problem is, this doesn't work, but I can't tell why. And as soon as I've worked out why it doesn't work, then I can fix it. So it's moving to that point.
Yeah. Sometimes it's just so helpful just to like say things out loud. Yeah. It's so nice to just like vent to somebody and be like, I have this issue. And as you're talking it out, you could just be like, oh, okay.
Thank you.
What if we did this? Wait, that came from me. That was my idea.
Also, read your dialogue out loud.
Oh, absolutely. 100%. I have that habit of like, I have a habit of going to like Barnes & Noble's and going to coffee shops to write, because sometimes if I write at my house, I just get distracted. And I look like an insane person because I'm mouthing my dialogue out loud. Well, not out loud, but like people could like see my lips moving to the dialogue and they're probably like, oh, she's off her rocker. No, I'm just a writer, I swear.
We have like an in-house thing at Felbetta, which is called something like the Harrison Ford test. But it's basically, you can write this shit, but you sure as hell can't say it, which I think you said to George Lucas. And it's that. It's like, you have to say it out loud because, like, yeah, it looks fine on the page. And then, oh no, no human would actually say that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. It's such a benefit at Telltale. We would like sit in, either the director or the writer would sit in on most of the VO sessions. And it's a huge benefit to just hear it out loud in the voice it's going to be and being like, oh, no, that doesn't sound right here. I can just change it right here in the room. Just go with this, say this, and then I'll change the text later.
They can't say the title of the game right there.
They can't say the title of the game. Whatever you do, don't do it.
They can't say there's a wolf among us.
Spoilers!
So along the same lines, when do you know that you're done with a script? Like, if you didn't have a deadline, would you work on a script forever?
Yeah.
Immediately.
I think yes. I'd reach the point of hating it, and then it would be also dead. Deadline or dead, one of the two.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I am a chronic perfectionist, and so if I don't have a deadline, like, that shit will never get finished. It'll always be on the next rewrite, so deadlines are good.
I think for me it's particularly because I went from editing to writing, because that was my original specialist and I expanded that way rather than the other. Most people go writing, editing. So my mindset is naturally, is this line the best it can be? So I write quite slowly my first draft, which means it's not as terrible as it could be, but it does mean that I'm always going, ooh, is that line? Like, just write the next line. You can do the rest of it later, but it's very much the whole, I will edit this until everything shines. It's like, no, don't, because you're going to have to change it all in about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So related to all this, how do you maintain a healthy work-life balance?
I am very lucky.
You don't.
You do. You do. You work at a non-terrible studio. There are some studios. Like, Felbetta is very good about this. We did have to work pretty fucking hard in some of the skies for various reasons, but we didn't crunch. I think a couple of people on the board did put in a couple of weekends here and then, but it wasn't what any other game studio calls crunch. And they're really strict about this, and that's kind of important, because I was still a freelancer when I first joined them, and then I was an employee, and I still had the freelance mindset, and so I'd do a little bit more work to try and look good. And I didn't quite get a bollocking, but I did get gently chastised, because they're like, well, you're not the most junior member here, so if you start doing overtime and people see it, then the junior staff are going to do it, and we don't want them doing it, so you just can't do it. And I was like, oh, now I feel bad. That is a way of stopping me doing things, is making me feel guilty. But
guilt.
Yeah, they're very good at not letting you do extra time. And if you need the extra time, you're meant to bring it up. It's a failure of production. And they'll discuss why this is happening, which is actually very lucky because it seems quite rare in the industry still.
Yeah.
Me personally, I still do side projects and personal things, and I am not excellent at this. The beginning of this year, I've recovered from it now, but we launched Skies. I was doing like a tiny commissioned IF piece, but it was still extra work. I was preparing for GDC. I was on a BAFTA jury. I was moving house. And by the end of GDC, I'm just like, I am so tired. I can't think. I literally went, I think I've used up all my ideas. Maybe I can't be a writer anymore. I've used up all my ideas. There are no ideas left. And then I just realized I was tired. And I had a week off after GDC, and I've just chilled out. I've just got one side project on. I don't have anything else. And I've suddenly gone, relaxing. It's amazing. People should do this more. And so like, if you're in a privileged position where you don't have to work every waking hour, then like, don't, because it will completely fuck your creativity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the really nice things about Telltale was they did have a unlimited PTO policy, which like most people didn't take advantage of because everyone was under the mindset that it would look lazy. But especially in the creative department, we kind of encouraged each other to take advantage of the PTO when we could, especially at the end of a project. Like I would take off anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks after finishing my responsibilities on a project, just to kind of like not write and not think about writing and just kind of like chill and recenter myself, which was incredibly helpful for when I would roll onto the next project. I find doing the work-life balance as a freelancer a lot more difficult because I have to make my own schedule, which means I have to carve out my own time for work-life balance. And because I am constantly trying to, you know, to go above and beyond and exceed expectations, it's a lot more difficult for me to tell my brain to shut off and just like go and like walk around and not write.
A thing my partner has found useful is actually almost doing sprint planning sessions for himself. So he'll look at the 2 weeks ahead and go, well, if I'm working 8 hours a day, 4 hours of which are deep work, because he splits it into like deep work, no interruptions, one focus on thing, you can't stop doing that thing. What will I get done? What will I need to get done? And then sets aside like 2 hours a day for medium work and 1 hour for light work, which is like emails and that kind of stuff. And he does more than I ever did when I was freelancing, just because it's so focused and the deep work is uninterruptible. Because I think there's also the thing with freelance that it's all your own time, so none of it is off time, but none of it is really fully on time, because you can always just stop for a half an hour break now. And I think that approach of actually structuring like almost a sprinted day job is really, really healthy, because you also go, well, I have done my hours today and now I must stop. And it doesn't even matter if you haven't achieved the thing you set out to. You know you've done a working day, which I think if I went back to freelancing, I'd definitely have to use, because when I freelanced, I'd work basically until I finished the work. And that would be weeks and weeks without a break. And then I'd go, oh, I'm tired now. And of course, you don't get paid holiday, so you don't get that side of it.
Right.
But a thing about unlimited paid time off, I think they've actually done a study and people take less holiday than if you have, say, 25 or 28 days, because you feel like you're taking too much and you don't know what's acceptable. Yeah. So what you should look for is a job with lots and lots of holiday, but allocated, not unlimited.
Yes, I agree. I absolutely agree.
I was going to ask about how do you manage your time efficiently, if, like used apps or if it came naturally, but Olivia, you pretty much answered that. But Jessica, how do you manage your time efficiently?
Time management has actually always been one of my weaknesses. Even like in grade school, I was not a good time management person. I have a calendar now. I have a week by week whiteboard calendar that I've been trying to use to basically section everything off accordingly, because I'm working several contracts at the same time. I don't know. I just like I follow a calendar and I try to stick to that, and sometimes I don't do as well as I would have hoped. But I've only been doing the freelancing thing for a handful of months, so I haven't quite gotten into the groove of what my system is. I hope to get there.
As someone who works with freelancers, a thing that's very important to me on the other side is freelancers giving me realistic estimates. So quite often I'm like, looking at an estimate and going, I don't believe them. And I'm always right. I'm always right. I've done freelancing. I know how busy these people are. And I'm just like, I'm not going to actually put that down as a day. And then occasionally I'll be like, really? Really? But like, also if people have problems and they tell me the second they think the problem might happen, I can actually often fix stuff or shift dates. But if they tell me after the problem has already eventuated and everything is fucked, I'm like, this is a bad time to tell me about this problem. Like, I can't do anything about it. So I think as long as you're working with a nice company, not all our companies are, like, being communicative about your deadlines and going, actually, I underestimated it. Sorry, can you handle this?
Yeah.
It's really useful, and it can stop you killing yourself, which is also good.
I tend to give myself a lot more leeway time in terms of estimates as well, because I'm typically a fast writer. I can get scenes done pretty quickly, but I find that, you know, even despite that, you know, not every single week is going to, because your brain can't be on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, every single week. So I've been trying to add in extra time when I give estimates and just be like, I don't know if I'm going to turn into like a log who can't write anymore this week. It comes and goes, man. And so giving myself leeway time is really, really important. And like you said, giving more realistic estimates than what you think you can achieve or what you hope to achieve just to look better for people is sometimes not always the best.
Yeah, I mean, it's also very useful. Like, I use Toggle at work, which just tracks projects. But it's good knowing how long a project has taken you, so you can actually then use that to extrapolate for future stuff.
Yep.
Because otherwise you're like, oh, that feels like it was 2 weeks. And it wasn't. You've been doing loads of extra time. And you're like, oh, I can do it in 2 weeks again. Like,
No, you can't.
Olivia, is there anything else you wish freelancers did?
If they talk to me, that's fine. Like, I can basically, whenever I work with freelancers, we're working with people we know who are already professionals, who are competent. And it's basically just ones who try to hide problems from us. I think possibly because of bad experiences with other companies, but it's just like, talk to us. We can fix things so much faster. So yeah, it's the whole when people work for us the free time and they feel they have to get perfect without having any help. And that's madness. In-house, we have help from each other. Like, yeah, I think just chilling out sometimes and being frank if they're having difficulties. I don't think anyone's ever really taken the piss, and like, we've always tried to accommodate issues. So I don't know, we're nice, we're not scary. Other places are, but since we're not, talk to us.
Build better games. We're not scary.
We're not that scary. We're nice. Yeah.
Are there any game stories that have been inspiring you both lately?
I haven't played that many games in the last few months. The one I played recently, actually, I'm really loving. I'm on New Game Plus, is Heaven's Vault.
I want to play it.
I want to play it so bad.
How much can I talk about it without spoiling it? No, definitely, definitely play it. It's not your typical game. I found it really relaxing, and it made me feel a sense of curiosity. And it scratched a very particular itch I have in gaming, which is I have to do side quests because, to me, it's a to-do list, and I cannot resist them. And yet, in Heaven's Vault, the language learning is kind of like a side quest, but you don't really have to do it. But if you do it, you'll naturally progress the story. So you don't end up in this whole thing where you're hunting 400 bears and 60 hours later you haven't seen any of the storyline. It's a really nice blend of you can pursue the main quest or you can pursue the side one and it'll take you through the main quest anyway. But I find it really interesting. Like, it's not a... I'm trying to, without spoiling it, it's not a game that would have like a Mad Max-esque dramatic soundtrack. But what's going on is interesting and powerful, but at a really human level, so it feels quite quiet. So I find it, I'm curious when I play it, and that's just a really nice sensation for me right now.
You're an archaeologist in that game, right?
Yeah.
That alone is made me want to play it.
That's from the developers for that did 80 Days, right?
Yeah, Inkle.
Yeah.
Oh, 80 Days is a good one.
Yep.
For me, I don't know, recently, like very recently, I haven't really been gravitating towards story-based games, mostly just because I work so much with stories on as my job, and so my downtime, I don't want to think about stories. Sometimes I just want to solve some puzzles. I just recently finished Breath of the Wild. And I know I'm like 2 years late on that one.
Nice.
You finished it though. I've got hours and hours.
I've rolled credits. I rolled credits on it like last weekend. I was so proud of myself. But like other than that, like that's the biggest game I've been playing right now. I find that what ends up inspiring me the most is actually smaller games with like really beautiful soundtracks and really beautiful art style.
Like what?
like, segue. So I played Greece? I don't know. I think it might be Greece because it's Spanish.
It might be Greece. It sounds like it's French.
Oh, Greece, yeah. But that game is stunning. It's beautiful. Like, it's such a beautiful game.
I found it incredibly beautiful, both artistically and like soundtrack and the movement. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, why did you bother putting these statues in? Like, it felt like they'd layered on a weird story that just irrelevant.
Yeah.
I get it was maybe supposed to be recovering colors to avoid depression? Question mark?
It's meant to be because there are achievements throughout it that are the stages of grief.
Right.
And so it's supposed to be about recovering from grief and mourning. And so, like, for me, I kind of just made up my own story by the end of it.
Yeah. I think it didn't need that. Like, almost, I would have been more interested if I'd been just left with, why is this world like it is?
Yeah.
But it was genuinely stunning, and I'm glad I played it. But yeah, it was just kind of like, I don't think the story they tried to put on top of this beautiful thing mattered. And if it didn't matter, why was it there?
Yeah. I didn't mind the story just because it wasn't really, not necessary, but it just wasn't at the forefront. Clearly what's at the forefront is like the puzzle and the art style and the mechanics and all.
The color washes, they're amazing. Like when they
The colors are so good. The watercolors, it's brilliant. And like the 2D animation on that game, so good.
Any other games with good visuals and music?
Oh God, so many. One that I come back to, and it's one of my all-time favorites, is Transistor from Supergiant.
Had their 5-year anniversary, I think.
They did. Gosh, I can't believe it's been 5 years since that game came out. It's such a stunning game.
All of their games are stunning to look at. And
I know, they're the most beautiful games ever.
They did Pyre as well.
Yeah. Pyre's great. I'm just really terrible at like the game Pyre game. The
You're
game
bad
within
at fantasy
the game.
NBA Jam.
I'm bad at fantasy Quidditch, and so
I rage quit the first time I played that because I'm okay at being bad at games as long as no one witnesses it. And my boyfriend's in the room, he's playing, and he's watching me. He's like, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "Go away! I'm so angry! I hate this game." And then like he was out one night, and I started playing it again, and went, "Oh my god, this is incredible!" The story and how it's okay if you even fail. It's just it's clever. Like, no, I genuinely I need to finish it, but it's a good game.
Yeah, that game has I need to finish it too.
Amazing NPCs. That slug That's, worm.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my god. Those guy. NPCs are so great.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm really excited. I haven't played Hades yet, just because like I keep updating their Twitter about like their most recent builds and things like that. So I'm just waiting for a slightly more stable build, I think, before I jump into that. Uh-huh. But Transistor is one of those games where it's like every single facet of that game works together so well, and the way that they show the story is really really fascinating.
With the upgrading.
Yeah, with the upgrades, with using the info kiosk booths that you can like hack into, it's just a really fascinating way to dish story out in little pieces, especially with a silent protagonist. Like, God, that game's so great. If you haven't played Transistor, play Transistor. It's like one of the first games that I played that made me cry at the end.
I was gonna say something with a soundtrack that. That still gets to me is Opera Din. Like, there are many, it's won every single award, but like the soundtrack, it's very clever. Like, it's tiny short bits that loop, but like I can hear someone playing the soundtrack just for a couple of seconds, like I am feeling tense, I am very stressed, because it's got that straight kind of connection right into my brain. That's a fascinating game also. I mean,
yeah,
it's won everything, so I think people know.
I'm trying to like build up a collection because I have a record player, and so I'm trying to like build a collection of like video game soundtracks that I love. And it's very small right now because vinyls are expensive, but it's like Transistor, Grease, as soon as that one comes out, I'm gonna get it. And Journey has a beautiful soundtrack.
What's your favorite game soundtrack, Jessica?
Oh fuck. It might be Journey. It's a toss-up between Journey and Transistor for me. Because, I mean, Transistor has, like, more traditional songs within it with vocals and things like that. But I think Journey is just, it's this incredibly moving soundtrack. Like the second I had a friend who had never played it before, and we were both at another friend's house, and we basically forced him to play Journey because we're like, it takes 2 hours, you'll be fine. And like the second that first song comes on, I got goosebumps everywhere. It's a beautiful, beautiful soundtrack.
People should play Journey.
Play Journey.
I'm counting my fingers. I'm like, oh, I like this game soundtrack and this one and this one. The Nationals song, I don't know if it's actually on the soundtrack for Portal. Absolutely love that one. There's a line about it's like marbles and glass, and I just love it. It's such a thing. I can't write to music that has lyrics. And so I enjoy things like the Firewatch soundtrack.
Oh God, that's so good.
That kind of thing it's good for evoking a particular mood. I know I wrote for it, but Where the Water Tastes Like Wine, that music is, I love it. It's stuff I can write to.
Yeah, that soundtrack's great.
And we also use the Witcher soundtrack for D&D sessions, and also I have it as some of my ringtones and stuff, and I think it's really, really good.
Yeah.
Last question. What are you two reading and watching right now that isn't video games?
Oh, God.
Or what are you consuming?
Yeah. Okay, it depends on which of my devices. On my phone Kindle, I'm reading The Burglar's Guide to the City, which is nonfiction. It's about...
I've heard of that. That sounds great.
Okay, it's architecture and what kind of crimes it basically... and how it enables burglary and stuff. It's interesting. On my Kindle, I've got the sequel to... Oh, God, it's Too Like the Lightning. I'm trying to remember. It's the sequel of another really good book. I'd have to type to find out, but that's... It's fantasy, I guess, or science fiction. It's like a future-based book, and it could be either fantasy or science fiction, but it's very good. By my bed, I have a Diane Wynne Jones book, because sometimes when I'm tired, I need to read something that's just real comfort writing, and I find that there's a particular category of children's writing that has to be better than almost any kind of adult writing, because children will not take... They will not, like, give... forgiveness in the way that adults will. Adults will, oh yes, I'll take that, makes sense, in a literary way. And so I'm reading the Crest of Mountsey series by Diane Wynne Jones. I mean, I've read this all my life, like it's something I come back to once every like 8 years, but I think her writing is incredible because it's very simple, but it's very poignant and it's very clever. And like the first book is clearly a child in what is probably an abusive household, and it's told in a way that I think if you read it and you're in that kind of household, you'd go, holy shit, this isn't good, as opposed to just accept. It's just good writing. And so, basically, I have about 4 books on the go at once. Wow. I'm watching Archer. There we are. I never saw it, so I'm catching up on Archer.
Do you switch back between books? Because I tend to just read one book and then move on to the next one. Do you, like, jump around?
Yes, but I'm also a very fast reader, so I can read a book in 2 to 4 hours. So sometimes it's I pick up books. Yeah.
You pick them up and put them down and you're done.
This is meant to, basically, I have so many because I have a commute book. I have a commute book from my Kindle. So it's that kind of thing. But when I'm at home, I tend to just start a book, finish it, done.
Wow.
That's so cool.
Archer's good too.
I'm a slow reader.
What are you consuming, Jessica?
I'm taking a break from media as a whole just because I finished Zelda and I'm fucking exhausted, but I'm reading a couple of things. I'm reading a nonfiction book called I think it's called Alice Diamond and the 40 Elephants. It's about one of the biggest all-female crime syndicates from the 20s.
Cool.
Which is awesome, but I'm kind of reading it for research for a thing. Maybe, I don't know. Not for a game thing. But I'm reading the Darker Shades of Magic trilogy by V.E. Schwab. I've read her other series, the Vicious series, which is very, very good. And that's slightly more sci-fi. So I'm reading Darker Shades of Magic, which is a bit more fantasy. And then I'm not watching a whole lot. I'm mostly watching like people be angry about Game of Thrones because I dropped out of Game of Thrones like in season 4. So I'm watching everyone like lose their mind, and it's very entertaining. I feel bad, but it's incredibly entertaining to just watch.
It's made me want to watch it because I read the books up until he stopped writing them. And I was just like, I'll wait. And I'm like, it's not going to happen. But now like everyone's so angry, I'm like, I really want to watch and see what happened.
I dropped it because there was just a little too much blood and gore just for the sake of having it. And there was a lot of sexual assault just for the sake of having it. that I was just, I've just felt very uncomfortable watching it. And I was actually getting like viscerally stressed leading up to watching the show. And I was just like, this isn't healthy. So I dropped it. And my life has been better because of it. But I do feel for everybody because I know what it's like to like be invested in a show. And then the last season just kind of like borks it, whether it's just because of pacing or story choices. I don't know.
I did see someone on Twitter describe Gerard Martin as very clever because he just got them to jump on the grenade of ending the series when...
Did you call him Gerard Martin?
I love it. I love it. It makes me so happy. Like, he's got so many R's. G-R-R-R-R-R, Gerard Martin. I don't know.
God. He stole it from Tolkien.
But, like, it is that. Like, it's he wrote up to this so at this point a very, very complex series and, like... He's let someone else do the, and not the hard bit, but kind of actually the hard bit of finishing it.
Yeah.
And I don't know, because I've not seen the TV series, I don't know if it's they've done it badly or it was just so fucking complex they had no way of tying it all up without fucking it. So.
Yeah.
I am intrigued.
That will wrap it up for the show. Where can people find you on the internet?
I am Babelfish Wars on Twitter because I'm a geek and Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is amazing.
And I am Kes Strauss, pretty much on any social media. Just reverse the J and the K in my name. And that's how you get it. Because I got that nickname in high school and I kept it.
And you can find this podcast at Script Blockcast on Twitter. Our logo was done by Lily Nishida. And our music was done by Mellow Mix. And that is it. Please leave a review. And thank you, too, for coming on again.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks.